Greetings and salutations. It's me, Robot Computer Voice Guy. Welcome to episode 60 of the Bigfoot Show, a hand and an arm and a thong. In this episode, we bring you an interview with naturalist David Mizajewski recorded on location in Area X, along with a conversation with the North American Wood Ape Conservancy's Daryl Collier relating recent events experienced by the group in their ongoing effort to establish the existence of the animal commonly referred to as Bigfoot. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
Okay, so this is the first anniversary. I'm sorry, the reunion show of the recently canceled yet apparently still continuing Bigfoot show. I am in the field. I'm recording live from Area X. Was that thunder? Cool. And apparently there's going to be a thunderstorm any second now. I'm here with David Mizajewski, actually, who is a friend of the show, been on before. I think it's episode like 46 or 47, The Miasma of Insanity. Hi, Dave.
How's it going?
Do people call you Dave?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't look like Dave. I don't know why I just said that, but
people call me both. And I started actually introducing myself as David because when I do things professionally, like when I'm on TV or, right, you know, when I am written in, you know, a publication or whatever, I prefer David. And if you introduce yourself as Dave, but say, you know, use David officially, no one does it.
Yeah, then you're pretentious. Then yeah. You just
say, so I just say, I'm David. So,
all right.
Yeah.
So, well, I'll call you David from now on.
Right. You can call me whatever you like.
So, yeah, I'm happy to say that I've spoken to David. God, now I'm calling you Dave.
See what I mean?
I don't know how that works. I spoke to David about coming down here, and here he is. And so we're very excited to have someone with his background and just understanding of nature down here with us. It's been fun. We're actually on a hike right now. We've stopped. We're sitting on some pine needles under some beautiful, I think these are loblolly pines. So just a gorgeous little spot, and we're just taking a rest. And so we thought we'd make a podcast. But it's been fun walking up here with him, because he's like, as we're walking along, I'm like, well, that's so-and-so, and that's so-and-so, and that bird over there is that, and, you know, I don't know. It's like, for me, like, all the plants are green and look alike, so that's kind of cool.
That's why my sort of brand is Nature Geek, because I can't help right, myself, you know. It's, you know, we saw the blueberries, and we saw the bunchberries, and, yeah. Heard the various birds and whatever, and so that's what I do.
You were calling out butterflies earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've now this is your second trip in here with us.
Right.
So, and you know, most people are not going to have the opportunity, of course, to come here, not only just here, but to come into a place like this. What's your impression of this place we call X?
Well, I mean, I think before we dive into that, just in case folks didn't listen to the last time I was on, you know, who am I, right?
So there are people who don't know who you are?
Definitely, yeah.
Wow. All right.
So,
if you think so, go ahead. Tell them who you are.
I'm a naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation, and I'm a fan of the Bigfoot Show. And
thank you very much.
I'm interested in the subject. I'm definitely way skeptical. My sort of scientific background and training, and you know, profession as a conservationist, sort of lead me to be skeptical. But my point of view is that I think that there's some interesting things going on with this subject. And I'm curious about it. And so when I stumbled upon the Bigfoot Show, it was the first time that I actually heard people talking about it with just the right amount of attempt at being scientific, but also appreciating all of the absurd that goes along with this subject. And, you know, for me personally, I'm a big geek, not just a nature geek. So I love sort of the monster aspect of this, whether or not there's a real animal. The naturalist part of me thinks it would be awesome if there was, you know, some undescribed giant ape running around North America, however unlikely I think that is. But then I also find just the phenomenon and the people involved. I mean, let's face it, some of it's pretty entertaining. Mm-hmm. So when I first started listening to the Bigfoot Show, you guys kind of nailed all of those three things in like the right balance. And I found it entertaining. And the more I listened, the more I learned about the subject. And yeah, I mean, I will say that I think that there's a possibility that something's out there. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing, though, is that the thing that keeps that little door open in my skeptical brain is the least usable or scientifically valid form of evidence, and that's the stories,
right?
The anecdotes. But, you know, Brian, the stories that you guys tell of what you've seen here, which I will say, this is my second time here, and I haven't seen or heard anything that would convince me that there are, you know, troops of big apes running around in these woods.
We guarantee it by the third trip. or your money back.
Right. But I hear the stories that, you know, that you tell. I mean, Kathy Strain's story from mm-hmm. last year, and some of the other folks on this trip that I've met, really amazing stories. And what it boils down to me for me is that either you guys are completely full of shit mm-hmm. and you're lying to me.
The lying bastards.
Which I don't believe. You know, I've met you guys. I've spent some time with you. I have a level of trust. So either you're lying, which I don't think is true. You are completely misidentifying and misinterpreting, which I do think can account for a large majority of sightings and other things. Just based on, again, my professional mm-hmm. experience, I know for a fact that most Americans are really bad at identifying wildlife.
Sure.
And they're proven to be really bad at being able to judge distance and size.
Right.
So I think that a huge majority of any sightings can be chalked up to that. But when I talk to you, when I talk to Alton, who's a wildlife biologist, to Kathy Strain, who is an anthropologist and has spent time in the woods, and some of the other folks here who are outdoors people that mm-hmm. know the difference between a bear and something that's not.
Right.
You know, and I've actually had some conversations with other people that are not part of this group and have never been here, who are wildlife biologists who work with wild animals every day mm-hmm. and who spend a lot of time out in nature doing wildlife photography, who have had sightings that I don't know what to do with that. So that's kind of where I'm coming from with this. I mean, I hear these stories. I can't write them off based on who they're coming from. And so I'm curious.
You enter into this interest via one of two doors, either the door of actually having some sort of encounter yourself that you believe to be squatchy, or what you're saying is you sort of become aware of this body of reported activity, and if you're lucky enough to actually get to know some of these people, it starts to become something where you're right. On the one hand, it's not scientific, but it's anecdotal, and it is a form of data, of evidence. But anyway, you get to this point where it's like you're trying to. It doesn't really matter, I think, to a certain extent, what's happening, because something interesting is happening. Now, either everyone is seeing an animal that isn't supposed to be there, mm-hmm. or everyone isn't, but to your point, not all of us sound crazy. So how do you...
just
some of us. And it depends on the day. But it's an interesting puzzle, regardless of the mm-hmm. solution, yeah. really.
And I share all that just to say that, again, I'm a skeptic, and I don't believe that there is anything out here until I can see for myself some kind of physical evidence, or, you know, a scientific institution that I have high faith in confirms it. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think that there is enough out there that warrants people looking into it for sure.
Right.
Whether or not it's a real animal or it's some other thing, some psychology or, you know, mass hallucination or whatever. I'm curious about what is at the root of all this, because there's definitely something going on, right?
Right.
I mean, there's definitely something going on. So,
I think, you know, and I think that you deserve credit for being in sort of the mental camp that you're in, but still willing to come out and see for yourself. Coming here is an investment, you know, mm-hmm. of time, of effort. And being with people you don't know, and spending time in a remote cabin with them, there's a quality there to be, I think, admired, because a lot of people are going to be skeptical and they will never leave their desk or their safe environment, and they'll just be skeptical in a very sort of, like, you know, high level mental way. But I think it's something that should be encouraged in those people who have the means and the interest in nature and everything else. They should get out there.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And,
yeah.
And decide for themselves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if nothing else, this is a fun week in the woods, hanging out with cool people and, getting some fresh air. And, I spend most of my time either in an office or on a plane or a train going back and forth to New York or LA. So,
right.
Doing my work. So getting to come out in the woods and just hang out for a week is actually kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Whether or not anything happens. So,
right.
But yeah, I mean, to get to your original question,
I had a question kind of,
Yeah, you wanted to know kind of what I thought of this place. So within that context of the point of view that I'm coming here, I think this place is, I mean, you're definitely right when you describe it as very remote. I can say for all the listeners out there who obviously have not been here, that the way you describe this place is pretty accurate. You know, you guys have had these things happen. And some people I know say, well, you know, there's people out in the woods throwing rocks at you and faking you out in the middle of the night.
What do you suppose the odds are now that you've been here, now that you've seen it, you've been around the region, mm-hmm. you know, we haven't gone real far away, but we've been around. Mm-hmm. What do you think the odds are that we could be being hoaxed by outsiders?
Extremely, extremely low. I mean, certainly there are ways that people can get in here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned the other day that, you know, you heard people on RVs rolling around, not right on the area.
Yeah, 4x4s, not RVs. Yeah,
4x4s. Yeah. And, you know, we found some trash and whatever on our hike. But to do what, you know, what you say is happening, throwing rocks in the middle of the night from a ridge through woods and hitting this very relatively small cabin roof, mm-hmm. no human can do that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and so if that is really happening... And I have to, you know, trust that what you're saying is true. And
yeah, you haven't still have not experienced one of those.
No, I haven't.
Right.
I don't know what to do with that.
Right.
Because if rocks don't just fly through the air. You need kind of a hand and an arm and a thumb to really grasp and throw one.
Did you say thong or thumb?
Thumb.
Okay, sorry.
All right, there's the name of this episode. Monkeys and thongs.
A hand and an arm and a thong.
You know, I mean, I don't know what to do with that. Either you're lying and it's not happening.
Right.
Or there's something that's in deep, dark, pitch black woods.
Yeah.
Way the hell out with no, like where the rocks are coming from.
Right.
There are no roads. I mean, you could hike. I mean, we're kind of close to the area where these things would be throwing, where we are right now.
Right.
Up at the top of the ridge here. There's no way that a human being could be doing it. There just isn't.
Maybe like once, but not, you know, for 3 months
right.
that we're down there doing our, yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah. I'm glad you think that.
Yeah, no. And, you know, like you were saying, I mean, it is remote. And it is kind of the perfect spot, I guess, to be out here doing what you guys are doing, because you can, with a pretty high degree of certainty, rule things out, like
right.
other people messing with you.
Right.
Whereas probably in other places you wouldn't be able to, because either it's not private property and there's right. not the control over who's coming and going,
right.
or because it's not as remote,
right.
so on and so forth.
There's limited access, and we can actually hear vehicles if they're as you know as our guys come in and out, or other people move through the area. We can detect their presence. Relatively easily, assuming they're not trying to be super, super stinky selfie.
Right.
But yeah, I think that the concept that someone is jacking with us from outside our control is unlikely.
Yeah. And then the second part of that is that if there were to be a species like this, I think it's very feasible that they would exist in an area like this. That's mm-hmm. sort of, you know, kind of out there. Not a lot of people come here.
Mm-hmm.
It's dense forest, lots of different types of forest as you go up in elevation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we passed huge blueberry patches on the way up here.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to guess that that would be food for an animal like this.
Right.
Certainly the bear, there's black bear
around. Supports a lot of bears.
That would be feeding on that kind of thing. So,
right.
So yeah, I mean, if there is a thing that's real, I could imagine it being in a place like this, without too much difficulty. But now I'm just
moving my recorder. Yes.
I want to see or hear these damn things. Well,
right.
You know, I've got another day here.
You need to be able to evaluate the things that we're saying. And we've heard a few things, right? We've heard, some strikes, but nothing that I would, we haven't heard like a grade A rock.
I mean, we've heard some crunching in the woods, but
yeah.
And everybody gets excited about that and everybody feels, oh, it's bipedal or,
right.
but I take all of that with a big, healthy grain of salt,
mm-hmm.
just because I have to, right?
I mean,
when you're forced to kind of try to come up with an explanation for something that you hear, you have to go with the most logical thing. And the most logical thing is that it's a known animal.
And so what he's talking about is last night after we were done eating, we heard what sounded like... steps. We sounded like something stepping through the forest, maybe I mean, I can't tell you how far it was well enough inside the forest that we couldn't hear it inside the overgrowth and the understory. And it sounded like it essentially walked from one direction, sort of the left hand side of the cabin, up around it, up onto the slope, to just about due north of it, and then it just stopped, and we didn't hear anything after that. So it sounded like slow, methodical, heavy crunching steps. And what you were able to see after that, though, because we became aware of the sounds, we investigated the sounds, we did the things that we do mm-hmm. when we are aware of that sort of activity around the cabin. But then you also saw us after the fact trying to walk through all of the possible scenarios. Mm-hmm. It isn't that we sat down and all just said, oh boy, howdy, there was a Bigfoot back there. You know, there was like, well, let's walk through the obvious candidates, you know,
deer, armadillo, possum, raccoon, possums.
We went through
bear.
All those. We even talked about, you know, whether or not it was a big cat or something. Mm-hmm. And all you can do, all anyone can do in that situation is say what we experienced, the behavior that we experienced did not seem to fit the profile of any known animal. Mm-hmm. And that's as far as we can go with it because we didn't see anything. Right. And the damn thing didn't throw a rock. If it thrown a rock, then clearly that would have been Bigfoot, right?
Yeah, but I think in that sentence, you know, you really have to emphasize seem. You know, mm-hmm. to the people sitting there at the time with their knowledge of wildlife and wildlife behavior and
right.
having spent some time here, that is the conclusion that you guys reached. Right. That does not mean that that is the answer, you know? And I know that you guys are knowledgeable, but unless you have some, like, that's not enough to convince me.
No, and I don't think it should be. It's just the most notable thing that's happened
yeah.
since you've been here, right? But yeah, it's not. Yeah, we heard some crunching in the woods. It's not. I don't think that would convince anyone that Bigfoot's real,
right?
Who didn't already think it?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the other thing that really struck me was coming in this year versus coming in last year and seeing the amount of clear cutting going on in the national forest land on the way in.
Yeah, you know, this is pretty common. If you look at the satellite images of the Ouachitas in general, but now there's been some cutting in sort of this sort of region of the area here in the Ouachitas, and it's I mean, I, you know, as I was saying on the way in with you, I'm familiar with how they quote unquote clear cut in my part of the country in Minnesota, which is generally smaller tracks mm-hmm. and they're sort of strips and they take them out of the woods and they leave some barrier plants and things. So when you find them, they're like big empty spots. But what you come over you come over a hill here and it's like gone yeah. from as far as you can see
yeah.
everything.
Yeah.
And it's like someone just sold every ounce of plant matter that was on that ground.
Right.
It's breathtaking.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I know that there are, you know, established logging practices mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. And that national forests are working forests and consumptive use is, you know, part of why they were created.
Right.
And obviously we need wood products, but,
right.
But when you see it, it is pretty, you know, it kind of takes the breath out, especially when you saw what it looked like before.
Right.
And of course, where my mind goes as a wildlife conservationist, is, you know, just the complete decimation of wildlife habitat. And mm-hmm. if you're talking about a potential species that lives in dense forest, you get into that kind of clear-cutting activity over such a wide area. I mean, it was just like ridge after ridge that were just completely gone.
Right.
That's got to have a huge impact. Or, you know, if these things are real, that's... I couldn't imagine that it wouldn't have a negative impact on their population.
Yeah, solely from the fact, and of course we have no way of knowing, you know, and I'm going to come this from, because I'm not skeptical about the existence of these animals, but we have no way of knowing if any of them lived in the area that was clear cut. But I do know that there were lots of bear living in that area mm-hmm. and there were lots of deer and, you know, and every other little creature that crawls the earth was living in there. All those animals had to go somewhere.
Right.
So that puts stress on the neighboring populations. Mm-hmm. If any other animal is fighting for those same resources, suddenly they're competing against more of this
right.
type of competitor. It just seems like there's got to be a better way to utilize these resources in a way that don't completely. And then there's, you know, what we also saw coming in is when they clear cut these things, what they replace it with is nothing like what they took.
Yeah, they do like a monoculture of stuff that's easily harvestable and all.
It's
that
just
kind of
dark
stuff,
green pine trees.
Yeah,
you know, uninterrupted dark green pine trees. And then right next to it, you'll have a plot that hasn't been logged, and it's all kinds of things.
Yeah,
you know, there's many different kinds of plants.
I mean, generally speaking, healthy ecosystems are diverse.
Right.
And the more diverse they are, the more resilient they are. And you have all these, you know, amazing interconnections, you know, food webs and just the ecology of the area, which is, you know, the interaction between the living things and them and the other living things in their environment and the non-living elements of their environment. And when you have that complexity, that's when you have, again, strong, healthy ecosystems that are resilient. And the more you make them simple, it's kind of like dumbing them down.
Right.
And then when you have issues like, you know, drought or, you know, climate change,
right,
these ecosystems are much more likely to collapse and not be able to recover.
Right.
So, you know, if you're thinking about a large species that relies on a certain kind of ecosystem, they're going to be sort of close to the top up there, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when the bottom starts to pull apart, you take enough blocks out of the bottom of that kind of pyramid, if you will, the stuff at the top collapses. And that's a message for us too, because mm-hmm. we're all the way at the top. There's an angry chickadee.
Not a bluebird though.
No.
I'm sorry, blue jay. inside joke on that. So the... to what extent, and this is all speculation, and this is not the first time anyone's asked this question, but how do you suppose, from your perspective, just sort of the field of conservation would be impacted if suddenly there was a new large mammal in North America?
Well, you know, it's impossible really to say, but I think if you guys are successful at establishing the species,
mm-hmm.
And by that I mean collecting a specimen, and having that physical evidence and having proper biological, you know, authorities or experts or whatever confirm that that is indeed what it is, that it is a, you know, undescribed primate that was taken in North America. You know, mm-hmm. if you guys do that, I think it probably would be pretty, pretty significant, mm-hmm. not just in the field of wildlife biology and then the ripple effect into the conservation world. But I think if you guys prove that this thing is real after all of this time and all of the sort of the mythology, the good and the bad and the stereotypes and, you know, the question about how human right. or how they're related to humans. And, you know, some people think they are human. Some people think they're monkeys, right? Or whatever. I think if you guys are successful at proving definitively that these things exist, that it's going to be a pretty big bomb, you know, in terms of how we think about ourselves as humans, all the way into things like religion, could be impacted by this.
Sure.
But
in the same way that I didn't introduce you. I also didn't, for people who maybe this may be the first Bigfoot show they've ever heard. We're actually here as part of the North American Wood Ape Conservancy's ongoing operations in the Ouachitas. This is the fourth year of long-term field research on top of about 10 years of sort of sporadic and in and out kind of things we've been doing up here. And the goal of the organization, one of the goals of the organization, is to establish definitively that this is an animal that lives. So if you didn't know that, now you do.
Right.
If you want more information, go to woodape.org.
Yeah. And I think, and when I say, I think, you know, if you guys are successful, I think the way your goal is the correct one. Mm-hmm. I think the only way that you're going to establish that this is a real animal and then therefore do what needs to happen to protect its habitat is to get a specimen. I totally agree that there really is nothing else, especially at this stage of the game. You know, a sighting story is not going to do it.
Right.
A footprint cast is not going to do it. No. A photo, a video, whatever. It's not going to be definitive enough. Or you can't rule out 100% that it's not a fake or a misidentification.
No, like as we were saying this other night, as if you spend time going through this, you know, if you spend time in this field, if you spend time, evaluating the various things that have happened and then the non-result of that happening, you if you follow this logical game, eventually you get to, you sort of like get in tighter and tighter concentric circles until you realize that the only thing you can do to really make a difference is to prove the animal exists. Mm-hmm. And the way that we've chosen to try to do that is the way that biologists have traditionally done that, and that's to bring in a specimen. I'm not saying there is no other way to do it, but this is the way we're doing it because, as we talked about in the last show, it is the most definitive and, to a certain extent, the most efficient mm-hmm. way. It's not any easier than any other way, but it will get the job done right. with the littlest amount of debate. What's important, I think, to me, and the reason why this year in particular, personally, and I know for many people in the group, you know, the logging activity that's happening so close relatively to where we are right now, we are at our heart a conservation organization. I think it's one of the reasons why you and us have some kindredship here. We speak in the same terms. Mm-hmm. We want the same things.
Right.
We are a conservation group, and it feels to me like, at least for the population that we've been interacting with, we believe we've been interacting with, it feels like there really is a ticking clock,
uh-huh.
that something is going to happen here
right.
if we aren't successful.
Yeah.
And I can't, obviously there are probably other populations in other places, but how many? We just don't know.
Right, and how many other places where you are experiencing the things that you're experiencing over the course of time?
Right.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of sighting reports here and there, and you know, but
right.
to be able to have a, you know, again, if these things are real, a spot where you know that they are present, where you can potentially set up, you know, a field study, like a real, right. true field study, which you guys are kind of,
we're trying to do.
You're doing it. What's the right word? Amateur is not the right word, but you know, you're not a you know, a biological institution.
Prosumer? Are we prosumers?
Prosumer?
Professional consumer. It's an electronics thing. What would you say as a naturalist and as a conservationist if someone said to you, regardless of the animal they were talking about, whether it was a badger or a Bigfoot or, you know, a blue jay, They've been there all along. They'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
There never seems to be an end to them. You know, we're always seeing them. We're always finding their you know, signs of their activity.
Right.
So how big of a deal can it be? Why do we need to be so worried about this whole conservation thing and changing our ways? Because
right.
haven't we been doing what we've been doing the same way all along, and
right.
they've survived thus far?
Well, I guess I have two responses to that. I guess number one is, sure, maybe, but maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should be doing whatever we can do, you know, to get the best data available on the species that share this planet with us, and really figuring out, not just guessing mm-hmm. about what their status is and what we can be doing to protect them and that kind of thing. And then the other answer would be, well, yeah, I mean, sure, we know the moon is up there. Let's not bother trying to study it more because
mm-hmm.
it's there. And, you know, I mean, what a, frankly, a shitty attitude when it comes to science, and like, science is about discovery
mm-hmm.
and expanding your knowledge and then applying that. And so, you know, that's just such an alien point of view to me. Of course we should be going out and trying to discover more about anything. And if there's a mystery, all the more reason why we should be doing it. But I will say this on that last point is that I know that a lot of people that are into this subject, and are trying to, you know, gather that evidence and get more data are frustrated because the science community sometimes scoffs at it and blows mm-hmm. it off. And certainly conservation organizations, you know, and I said this last time and I feel the need to say it again, just the disclaimer that, you know, I'm here because I'm interested in the subject. We're friends.
Mm-hmm.
This has nothing to do with National Wildlife Federation, who does not recognize that the species exists, and nor should they until that science is there. But, you know, we're focusing on species that we know are, you know, that exist, that are need our help.
Right.
And when you work in conservation, you learn pretty quickly that the sad reality is that we're up against what sometimes it seems like insurmountable, you know, forces. You know, we don't have the budgets of the, you know, the companies and the countries that are pushing a lot of these species into the precarious position that they are. You know, I mean, I learned early on in my career that it's really easy to get burned out because we never have enough time, money, or people to do the job that we're doing because we care passionately about it. And so when somebody says, oh, there's big monkeys in the woods, but let's you know, fund us, or, you know, let's get an effort to get a protection thing. You know, we're like, you know what? Fuck you. Because we're trying to save these species that we know are already out there. That so I can appreciate that people get frustrated by that.
Right.
But people who are interested in this subject have to accept the fact that until you can demonstrate that they're real, you should not expect any help or input from conservation groups that, you know, again, are doing their best.
Well, there's limited resources
with what they have.
And
but that only emphasizes my point that I respect you guys for doing what you're doing, especially since it is kind of controversial, the whole idea of taking a specimen and devoting the time that you guys have spent out here. I mean, I said this to you last night when we were sitting around the campfire. I'm interested in this subject. I have fun coming out here, but I could never devote the time and money and just sort of personal energy that you guys do. And I think it's great that you are, because that's what it's going to take to move this subject one way or the other.
Right.
And I'm glad you're doing it. I'm glad I'm not doing it though.
It's one of my, my favorite, you know, the sort of more skeptically bent, or not even skeptically bent, because some of these guys aren't skeptics when it comes to the subject, but this notion that, no, you know, we're just out here hanging out with our buds in the woods as we would be doing anyway. And I can tell you that to a man, we wouldn't be hanging out as we're hanging out, where we're hanging out, for as much as we're hanging out. This is clearly not about just having a good time in the woods. This is you know, arduous, and you know, there's some of our guys are going to be down there. Like, we have one, Travis, who's been on the show before. I think he's scheduled for 6 weeks.
Yeah,
which is 6 straight weeks down. Yeah, living in a hollow.
And the fact that you guys are, you know, doing this on your personal time and giving up your vacation time and time away from your family.
No, I'm told there's a huge tax advantage, though. I keep looking for that. You know, I think, again, you know, what you were saying about the goal of your organization and just of conservationists in general. And one of the things that excites me about the possibility of proving that this animal is real is that there'll be other positive effects. You know, and this is why I think, even though your organization refuses to acknowledge the existence of the animal, what you do still benefits. I mean, all this stuff is connected, right? I mean, that's the sort of the defining nature of nature, right?
Yep.
It's all connected. So if you're helping or protecting a piece of it, you are by definition helping other pieces.
Well, that's actually a strategy of conservation organizations. This is why oftentimes you see campaigns for what we call charismatic megafauna, because, I mean, let's face it, you know, a little faceless invertebrate that is highly endangered.
Right.
It's really hard to get the public to care about that.
Right.
But, you know, you put, a wolf out there, or, you know, something else that is furry, and people can have some kind of...
That's really cute when it's a baby.
Yeah, exactly. it just gets people a lot more engaged. So we focus on those species not only because they need our help, but oftentimes they are keystone species or higher up on kind of like the hierarchy. And if you save them in their habitat, you're also saving hundreds or thousands of other species.
Right.
So absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when we are fighting, you know, mountaintop mining or, you know, working on the issue of climate change and its impacts, like the wildfires that are raging in California and Alaska, and it seems like everywhere in the West, we're doing it for the non-charismatic species as well as the charismatic species.
I bet baby wood apes are adorable. I bet they are the cutest little buggers. Well, I've seen Todd Standing has a picture of one of them. They're just when they're small, they're so fuzzy faced,
almost like dolls.
almost with doll-like expressions.
Those blank, you know, craft store eyes.
The blank stare. Well, speaking of which, we were talking, I have not been able to muster up the intestinal fortitude to do it, but you actually watched the Survivor Man.
Yeah.
Well, we saw the second half.
I saw the second half, yeah.
Since that is the kind of thing we should be talking about on the show.
Right, yeah.
I'll leave it to you to talk about it.
So, I caught the second half, and, you know, I'm a fan of the Survivor Man. I don't sit and watch it religiously.
But when I catch it, I
think it's a good show.
Yeah, he's awesome.
And Les Stroud seems legit. And,
totally.
And, you know, he's had his experiences where he heard noises that, and this is the perfect example of what I was talking about earlier. I have a pretty high level of confidence when someone like Les Stroud says that They've heard something, an animal noise in the wilderness that they can't identify.
Right.
I have a high level of faith in that because he knows what he's talking about.
Spends a little time in the wilderness.
Exactly, right. So again, I don't know what to do with that.
Right.
And the thing that I liked about it is that he seems to be approaching it from the same point of view, even in that special with Todd Standing.
Even with Todd Standing?
Yes. He was very much like...
Did Todd show him his puppets?
Well, he did at sort of the climax of the episode, but we'll get to that in a second. But you know, I mean, Lestrade was being... probably more favorable to Todd Standing than you or others would be. But he flat out recognized, he's like, he could be completely lying to me. He, you know, this could all be made up. But he is approaching it again from sort of that skeptical point of view with a desire to want to know the answer,
right,
even though he doesn't accept 100% what certain people are saying is the answer. So I think you should watch it. I don't think you'll want to hurl up your lunch as badly as you think you will.
Right.
Until of course you get to the footage of Blinky,
right,
the clearly CGI blinking wood ape Sasquatch, you know, and that's the thing, you know, when I see that, it's disheartening. It's like, really? Don't get me wrong, whoever did the CGI on that did a really good job, but I mean, the thing that kills it though is the exact thing that I'm sure when they did that, they were like, all right, we've got to make it move. Let's make it blink. The minute you see that thing blink, it's like, oh my God, that's completely fake.
Right.
And when you see some of those other photos that he put out, the ones that are like clearly craft store construction.
Yeah. As they're like sort of artfully peeking through the foliage. Yeah.
I mean, it looks like, you know, rejects from like the prototype for Ewoks back in like, you know, the 80s where, you know, they're...
Ewoks weren't so hot either, but yeah, clearly they look like an Ewok prototype.
Yeah. So
you think Bigfoot Show listeners, if they haven't, they should probably give it a watch.
Yeah. I mean, again, I watched the second half. I actually, somebody posted it to YouTube. I don't know if it legally or not.
Oh, so you pirated it. You're a pirate.
Well, I didn't pirate it. I just watched it. I didn't do the pirating myself.
That might be illegal too. I'll cut that part.
Blame it on YouTube.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I randomly... It popped up on my suggested thing, and I wasn't even thinking about it, and I just, you know, I started watching it, and I was like, oh, okay. You know, he's also got footage of himself. Well, by footage, I mean he recorded pitch blackness with a flare and him kind of shrieking into the woods, and you hear things kind of crashing through and, you know, being threatening, and he's hyperventilating and freaking out.
So he's trying to scare something away.
Yeah, well, he apparently was hiking. This is Todd Standing, not Lestrade.
Oh,
yeah,
screw him.
Yeah.
All right.
But right, so that they also aired.
Oh, right. You were talking about. Okay. Yeah. Yeah
they
yeah.
also aired that bit of footage, which, you know, if you're gullible and you're just watching that, of course you're going to be like, oh my God, you know. But that could so easily just have been Todd standing freaking in the woods out, right, with a flare,
with his friends shaking trees.
Yeah.
I mean, and we were saying this yesterday. It just because he plays with puppets and computer programs doesn't mean that he hasn't had legitimate encounters,
right,
but the it doesn't really matter,
right,
if, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the little bit, and I'm not anywhere near as deep into this stuff as you are, but the little bit that I know about him, he strikes me as somebody who really does truly believe and maybe has seen these things, but for whatever reason, he has decided that he needs to... fake it to get people interested. And maybe it's in his mind the same logic that I was just talking about why conservation groups choose charismatic megafauna. I mean, we're not lying when we say these animals need our help, but it's a strategy.
But you would to if get... you had to.
No, we would not. But it's a strategy. It's a strategy employed to get a greater good. And I think some people that are involved in this Bigfoot thing... think that is justifiable.
Right. Well, Scott's talked about it before on the show, that ends justify the means. There's some people in this field that feel like they can do whatever they want.
Right.
Whatever they need to do, because it doesn't really matter how we get there as long as we get there.
Right. Yeah.
So
that's kind of what the impression from the little bit that I have watched and heard about Todd Standing is, but I don't agree with that in this instance. I mean, if that's what he's doing, I just think he's cutting himself, you know, he's doing more harm than good. Because that's the kind of thing that real biologists and the scientific community and conservationists look at and just roll our eyes. And it just puts your cause like three steps backwards.
Absolutely.
It just does.
Because we're stuck with them.
You know, and that's the same for Finding Bigfoot. and shows like it. And while I do think that the shows like Finding Bigfoot are going to be the inspiration for the folks 10, 20 years from now that are going to be doing what you're doing right now, assuming you're not successful here.
Of course we will be, but yeah, assuming.
You know.
Let's just pretend.
From that point of view, I mean, they're entertaining shows, and they're going to pique people's interest, and those people that are going to go further into it are going to do it because their interest was piqued. Just like my interest was piqued in this by seeing TV shows on it when I was a kid.
Right.
Just like yours were from seeing Boggy Creek. So
yeah, Boggy Creek in Search Of and all those. And
which frankly, I think I watched recently for the first time.
Boggy Creek or In Search Of?
Boggy Creek.
Yeah.
And after you raving about it on the show, because I'm a few years younger than you, so I was a little too young when it came out.
You keep pointing that out. That you're younger than... So what did you think of Boggy Creek?
You've done it on more than one occasion. I mean, I thought it was like laughably hokey. Like it was not scary to me at all.
Imagine you're 9.
Right. But this is my point. for people who are, I would call like maybe sort of the hardcore people that are into the world of Bigfoot, in which I would put you and, you know, like people like Scott. And Scott is known to rail on Finding Bigfoot. My point is just that when you had the same experience when you watched this hokey, schlocky horror movie when you were a kid and it got you interested. Right. And so to you today, or for a person like me today, as an adult watching it, it does seem silly and ridiculous and whatever. But I think that Finding Bigfoot might be playing the same kind of role for the next generation of people that are going to investigate this. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, half of what they say in that show makes my eyes roll, but, you know, I think it's not as, it serves the role for the echelon of people that are interested in Bigfoot, which are not the high level hardcore people like you guys.
We're the elite, I think.
The elite, we're the elite. That is the word that I used earlier.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? So
we're going to get like, special jackets with like silver insignia.
Yeah, it's really easy to get really into you know, a subject or a profession and then poo-poo anybody else that isn't as cool as you.
Right.
And that's kind of what it feels like when people really rag on shows like Finding Bigfoot.
If I did that, I would be doing it all day long, because clearly. Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I think that Finding Bigfoot is kind of like a gateway drug for a new generation.
Mm-hmm.
And it, apparently, even though it's been canceled, canceled in that they just stopped making them.
Right.
It's gonna go on for
didn't
a
get
decade.
Renewed. There's
a
difference.
Yeah, it didn't get renewed
between being canceled and not being renewed.
It's gonna be sucking people in for a long time to
come. Yeah. Well, I mean, having hosted a series on Animal Planet, I know what goes into making a show like that, and I know, you know, what the networks are looking for, and you know, this is cable, so they're gonna repeat the crap out of Finding Bigfoot for probably the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Easy. So it's not going to go away. It'll just be reruns.
Well, it seems like it's only been recently that we stopped seeing Monster Quest, and Monster Quest hasn't been in production for about that long, I bet.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's just the business model. You know?
So in the general world of Sasquatchery, what sort of things have been making you roll your eyes lately besides Buggy Creek, which is genius, and you're just wrong, but go ahead.
I mean, nothing specific, I guess, but I mean, it's things like watching Finding Bigfoot and hearing like the frankly absurd shit that comes out of their mouths about, well, of course it's blah, 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 you know, and like just rampant misidentification of animals. And again, part of this I know is not their fault. It's,
right.
You know, it'll be like, oh, it's, you know, here's a sign of a beaver. And then up flashes a porcupine, you know, and like most Americans, like I started saying earlier, are really piss poor at identifying wildlife and it doesn't make a difference for them. But if you know what you're doing,
right.
I mean, with my Animal Planet series, that was one of the things that I told them. I was like, I'm not going to be hosting the show if you're going to put the wrong species up. If I'm saying it's a redback salamander, you need to be showing a redback salamander.
Not any salamander.
Right, exactly. And so I got them to agree to let me watch the episodes and make notes before. And it made a lot of extra work. And it made the production company, I think, hate me a little bit. But we put out a much better quality show as a result.
You know, and to be fair to the guys on the show on Finding Bigfoot, I think that was something that they struggled with at the beginning.
Absolutely,
too,
yeah.
The production company was doing their own thing.
Right. And that's how the hierarchy of these things work. You've got a network, you've got a production company, and everybody else doesn't get a say.
Right.
You know, which is kind of the way it should be because they know their business best. They know how to make a TV show that is going to be on for 5 seasons.
Right.
And when you get anybody from a specific subject matter like conservation in my case, or Bigfootery in their case, right? They don't know jack about what goes into making a good TV show. So the networks are certainly not going to hand over creative reign to, you know, or whatever, the guys who do Pawn Stars. Like, they're not making the show and calling the shots on how the show structure is. And
no, but they're cashing those checks. That's for sure.
Oh, hell yeah. So, so.
Did you happen to catch the Brian Sykes thing, the BBC?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, not BBC, the Channel 4 thing.
And I didn't. I think there were there were three episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I caught two of them and, you know, thought it very interesting and, obviously, I hate when people say, oh, that was interesting.
That was very interesting.
That's what people say about this Bigfoot stuff all the time. That's one of the things that makes me roll my eyes. Like,
interesting.
But I just committed it myself. So, yeah.
I'll just edit that out too.
Things like watching that is what led me to just kind of own up to that conclusion that the thing that keeps me interested and holds that teeny tiny door open that maybe there is actually something real, a real animal for me is, are the stories. Watching that those Brian Sykes shows where, you know, he kind of debunks a lot of things when he actually applied science to it. And it's easy to see that and be disheartened. But again, I go back to if I had just watched that and didn't have the conversations with people like you and others that have had these encounters that I don't know what to do with, I probably would completely write it off and I wouldn't be here.
Right.
So, I mean, the whole bit about the Yeti being, you know, some relic bear species, I find interesting, but I also find that very hard to believe.
Yeah.
You know, almost as hard to believe that there's a, you know,
it's not unknown, especially in TV shows. And as we were saying yesterday and have talked about a little bit here on the show, a TV show's job is to get people to want to watch it, and how you do that really doesn't matter, right? Nobody's making a TV show because they want to tell the world about a subject. They make a TV show because they want advertisers to pay for commercials.
Absolutely,
right?
100%.
So, so that being what it is, a lot of these shows, they'll take one piece of evidence, they'll analyze it, they'll make a conclusion, and then they'll dismiss everything because of this one piece of evidence.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what the TV shows do. And I don't know how much, say,
And they want to end. They want to end with, like, this big, like, we have conclusively decided.
Or we have conclusively said that there's no such thing.
Right. The Yeti is a bear. Done.
Well, TV, what people probably...
And the Yeti might be a bear. I just want to put that out.
Yeah. Take for granted that TV really is just a vehicle for storytelling.
Yeah.
And the elements of a good story are drama, controversy, suspense, and conclusion. You know, to have a good story, you need to kind of take the listener, the viewer, or whatever, kind of on this journey.
Right.
And if it's going to be a satisfying story, you need to have those elements. And so that's why, you know, you see shows like Finding Bigfoot or my series, which was called Backyard Habitat, have a formula.
Is that on Netflix?
It might be. I mean, it's been a while. I mean,
it's got to be on Amazon, right?
We have a best of DVD.
Excellent.
With I think 12 episodes, although they're like the first 12 episodes and they're definitely not the best of out of the 47 because, again, I never had any training being on camera. I'm a naturalist. I was running a program at National Wildlife Federation on restoring urban and suburban wildlife habitats. So basically like gardening for wildlife, you know, what native plants to plant in your garden, what things to rip out, not using pesticides, water conservation. And I wrote a how-to book on it in 2004, and Animal Planet turned my book into a series, like a makeover series, when makeover series were like really hot. And so, but we had a formula for every episode, just like Finding Bigfoot.
Right.
So if that frustrates you as a Finding Bigfoot watcher, just know that that is the way the TV is done, so that you kind of have this story that gets told and a progression. And the formula, of course, just makes it easier for the production companies to make these shows with the tiny budgets that they're given from the networks. And, you know, and so it is what it is. You're not going to change that. And if you try to make TV something that it's not, you're just going to be disappointed.
Right.
So go into watching these shows knowing that and take it for what it's worth. And sometimes for what it's worth is that you get to roll your eyes at shit that Matt Moneymaker says,
right?
Which is what I do.
That's not a bad evening spent at home.
No,
actually.
Exactly. Right. Order a pizza and
make fun of Matt.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I think if people get that, they'll be able to enjoy it for what it's worth and take away any interesting things out of it. I mean, for me, the most interesting part about that show is hearing the people tell their sighting stories.
Yeah.
And you know, and some of that is just entertaining because obviously some of those people are out there and loony and just saying whatever, but,
right.
But maybe some of them aren't, and maybe some of them saw something and they misidentified it, but maybe some of them aren't.
Right.
And as I've said a couple times, that is what keeps my interest peaked in this, is that can everybody have misidentified
there? Are they all crazy?
There?
Are they all nuts?
Right. Are they all nut jobs? Right.
Are they all lying?
And I think that is just as implausible as an 8-foot ape running around in the woods. So I don't know what to make of that. And I will be a skeptic, and I will not.
I've been there. You'll come around.
Yeah.
We'll take care of it.
Well, listen, when you throw a big, you know, a hunk of wood ape in front of me, then I'll believe you.
Any questions from the peanut gallery? Really? Wow. All right. Anything else that you want to cover?
I don't think so.
All right, cool.
If folks want to follow me, I'll give my shameless plug.
Shameless plugs.
I'm on Facebook at Naturalist David Mizajewski. Just remember M-I-Z, and that will get you to the page.
Google it, yeah.
My name is long and hard to pronounce. But yeah, I mean, if you want to find out when I'm going to be doing my next TV appearance, or you want to chat about wildlife or conservation and any of that kind of thing, that's a great place to find me. I'm also on Twitter, so at D Mizajewski. So.
And you were saying last night how often are you on Conan?
I do Conan.
You're on Today Show like once a month.
Yeah, I do the Today Show once a month, sometimes twice. And I, you know, what I do a lot of TV appearances where I bring on animals, wildlife, animal ambassadors,
right,
is what we call them, to help get people excited and interested in joining the National Wildlife Federation and just, you know, kind of getting involved in conservation. So that's the other place people should go is check out National Wildlife Federation's website. It's nwf.org. And if you want to get involved in conservation, we have a million and one ways, and we really could use everybody's help, whether that's financial, whether that's getting involved in our, you know, sort of our action, activist kind of work, or, you know, subscribing to Ranger Rick magazine and getting your kids involved and getting them out in nature. There's lots of different ways that you can engage with us and do something good for the wildlife and for the planet and yourself too.
I used to get Ranger Rick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome.
Look where we are right now.
Exactly. That's what I always say when I'm doing my sales pitch for Ranger Rick. It's like, look where I am.
Right.
You know, so, yeah. But yeah, I do a lot of TV shows. I do Conan O'Brien. I'm going to be on in a few weeks. I do Wendy Williams and all the morning talk shows and all that kind of stuff. So,
cool.
Which is why I'm always on a plane or a train to New York or LA. So,
well, we're gonna shut this down and we're gonna hike back to camp and hopefully get you a rock throw or something.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
So we'll see what happens.
All right.
Thanks awesome. A lot, David.
No problem.
What are you drinking?
Some kind of energy drink. All right. Well, I wanted to get on the Skype with you today to talk about what we're doing for persistence. I'm sorry, tenacity.
Yeah, so, you're a couple of names behind.
I can't keep up, man. I can't keep up with your. What's the next one going to be called? Do you know yet?
No idea. something to do with perseverance and, you know, I mean,
you've already used tenacity.
We used endurance. We used persistence. Relentless. We're on tenacity.
We're going to have to break out a thesaurus.
I like Operation. I like Resolute. I like that.
Oh, Resolute would be good. Of course, Resolute. Oh, yeah. No, that should be the next one. Resolute. I like that a lot.
Operation Resolve. You know, one of those.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, what are we now? Four weeks into tenacity.
Yeah, we started our fifth week yesterday. 15th.
Right. So what I thought we could do, this show is going to be basically, I got an interview with Miz that we did out there in the woods, and now I figured we could just sort of like bookend that with a conversation with you about sort of what's happened so far. We're about a month in. So first question I have is for those who aren't aware, what sort of changes did we make to our tactics going into this year?
Well, I think we're probably still using, variants of the same tactics we've tried in the past. It's just that we've increased our technological capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've now got we've now got an Overwatch that is elevated. And when you factor in the height of each person and the chairs from which they operate, I would say we've got a, we're up at about 15 to 16 feet.
So describe what we've got now. So last year, for everyone who might not know or can't remember, we had basically, it was like a just a shelter tent kind of thing with like a, what would you call that? Like a shade tent kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it was a canopy tent.
Right, a canopy. And then we had wrapped it with plastic.
That's it. It was just a canopy tent with black plastic trash bags for walls.
Which and the thermal can see through.
That's it. The thermal optics can see through very thin polyethylene plastic.
So that was pretty crude. What do we have now?
And so now what we did, well, actually what we devoted a large part of our fall and winter to was reconstruction and building a tower where the east porch of this cabin used to be. It's now a deck on the bottom, and then we have a ladder that climbs up. You can climb up into this under the second deck. And up on the second deck is a canopy tent with the polyethylene walls. Mm-hmm. So basically, we took the Overwatch tent from ground level and put it up on this deck, which is now, the deck is actually 11 feet up.
Right.
But like I said, when you factor in the chairs and the height of each person, then they're looking at about 15 or 16 feet up. And it's right there beside the cabin. It's not out away from the cabin like right. It was last year.
So that gives us two things. First of all, it's a much sort of a physically more less taxing operation now. If you're sitting in there, it isn't like it, before it was, you know, you kind of had to hunch over a little bit if you were tall and you were standing the entire night. But now we have chairs that they can sit in.
Yeah, we use the chair, what are those, Caldwell Deadshot chair pods.
Right.
You can mount a weapon on the, it has a rest for you to mount a weapon on. And so your weapon just rests on this mount, and you don't have to hold the weapon all night. If you're not even using the weapon, you don't have to hold the thermal scope or the thermal optic because it's mounted on the weapon.
Right.
And you can just rotate your chair. The chairs rotate 360 degrees, and they have a vertical horizontal capability that allows you to move the arm up or down or any which direction you want to look. And so fatigue has really been taken out of the factor, or is no longer a factor. It's been taken out of the equation. With the exception of just your normal fatigue that you get when you're staying up all night,
right? 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. I mean that's still a factor, and there's really no way to get around that other than you try to prepare for it.
Right.
But as far as getting fatigue from holding a weapon or holding the thermal. That sort of thing, that's no longer a factor because you're seated pretty comfortably in these chairs.
And now, of course, we've got the tactical advantage of height. We're higher up now. So I assume that we have a better view of what's happening around us.
Yeah, it's always better to be elevated. It always gives you an advantage. And so, you know, being 15 feet up, it definitely gives you a better view just in and of itself. And then we're in a position now that we can see basically, I'd say about 300, maybe 300 degrees, not 360, because on the west side of the cabin, there's a blind spot there.
Right.
So we're, that's sort of a weakness, but we can see all around that cabin with just great visibility. I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah. It's a pretty cool thing.
And so we purchased, we had the ATN Thor thermal scope last year, and we purchased a second one this year. Mm-hmm. So now we have two rifles up there in that Overwatch tower. We tested some big bore weapons last year. Some of your listeners may recall, and others may not have even heard about it yet. Last year we used a .30-06 with a thermal scope mounted on it. .30-06, it's a very potent weapon, but I don't know that we'd really call it a big bore. And we had thought about going to testing a big bore weapon, like a .45-70. Well, we were able to test that, and it's working well. And we also
and the concern was that the thermal wouldn't be able to withstand the recoil of the weapon. Is that what the issue was?
The mount, not the actual.
Right. So the thermal's okay.
the mount that holds the thermal optic to the weapon. We thought there might be some weakness in that with these big bore Magnum loads we're using and the rifles we're using.
Yeah.
And so, we tested that, and they're working well. We also bought a Seiko 338 Lapua with a shortened barrel into the mix. So we've got two very, very potent big bore weapons at our disposal. We haven't had the chance to use them yet.
No.
But, you know, there's a chance that that could happen.
We did have, I would say that to the best of my knowledge, we've had one possible / probable sighting through the thermal from Overwatch. Do you want to relate that story? You know the one I'm talking about, Ed?
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. It was one of the things that I'd thought of. I was going to bring up high points of each team that's been in there, and that was definitely one of the high points of Alpha. That was during the very first week. Ed Harrison and Rick Hayes were on Overwatch. Overwatch is what we call when we send somebody up into the Overwatch Tower, and then it's their job to man that and to scan and scope around and see if they get a target to shoot. And so Rick Hayes and Ed Harrison were on Overwatch. It was, as I recall, it was about 3:30 in the morning. And a rock hit a shed right beside the Overwatch Tower, got their attention. So then Ed started scanning up along the mountain slope for movement. And he did see a small signature. It was a small white signature. And depending on how you have the thermal optic set, you can change the colors, but he had his set in black and white mode so that everything that is very hot, mammals for instance, would appear is really white, really bright white in his thermal. And he did see a bright white signature, an animal, but he couldn't see much of it. He could only see a little part of it, and that's the way it is when you're looking through very deep foliage. You're lucky to see any part of it. And he watched this thing, you know, moving down the slope. And again, he had heard a rock come from there. He heard it come through the leaves. You could hear the trajectory through the leaves, and then it hit the shed roof, the tin roof. So he looked up there, and that's when he saw that signature, and he saw it moving down the side of the mountain. He still didn't have a good visual identification for what it was. He didn't really know. I mean, he had an idea that it might be a wood ape, but there was no way to know for sure. So he followed it down. And directly to his west, there is an open meadow area that funnels into this really tight tunnel of foliage, and we call that the bottleneck because the foliage bottlenecks into this really small tunnel that you walk through. It's a trail that walks through there, but there's a meadow right in front of that. So he watched this thing come to the edge of this meadow, still behind foliage, and then he sees right there at the edge of that meadow, this signature, it stopped behind this big 3-4 feet tall clump of vegetation, and he could just see like the top of this signature.
Yeah, like a straight, sort of like a straight back or something.
Yeah, like what it might appear to be if a person were, you know, squatted down partially behind this clump and looking at him.
Right.
You know, maybe the shoulders elevated. You know, and this, whatever this was, it was there, and it was stationary for about 3 or 4 minutes, as he tells it. Didn't move, it wouldn't dare step out into the open. And then it just sort of faded back off into the foliage. I think that probably was an ape. The behavior was very uncharacteristic of all the other wildlife.
And that's the thing, you know, if you are going through your mind the various animals that it could have been, the other candidates that we know live in the area, bear obviously could have been it's a big animal. We know they're there. We've seen them from Overwatch. There's cougar. There's a deer. You've seen lots of deer from Overwatch. This didn't behave like any of those kinds of animals.
Not at all. In fact, Travis Lawrence is there now. And I talked to Echo Team yesterday. Last night, as a matter of fact, the highlight of the night before was a black bear that Travis saw from the Overwatch Tower, and it was in the same area. And this black bear, it didn't stop behind a clump of bushes and just, you know, become stationary. It entered out into the meadow.
No, bears are not thoughtful animals.
That's the thing. I mean, nothing else in there is quite, not even nearly as leery and wary and reticent as these animals are. I mean, this was almost like the thing knew that there might be some sort of danger if it stepped out.
Right. So why didn't you just shoot it, Daryl?
Well, he didn't have a clear shot.
So what are the rules that we have down there for guys in that position?
Well, I mean, it has to be a clear shot. I mean, he has to have a positive visual identification of what he's shooting. You have to be able to identify it.
So he has to be able to make out the form of the animal. He has to know what it is that he's about to shoot.
Absolutely. Yeah. And preferably you get confirmation from your partner if you have a partner.
Right.
And also the rules of engagement say that there can be no human within a certain arc.
Right.
Of the direction in which the Overwatch operator is looking. So had there been any humans within a certain area down there, he wouldn't even be able to shoot anyway, even if he did still be identified as a wood ape. So, yeah, it's pretty tight rules of engagement we have because we want to make sure that, you know, we're operating within certain safety parameters at all times.
Right.
But he just didn't have enough to shoot at all. I mean, all he saw was the top of this thing and appeared to be peering over this 4-foot clump of vegetation. And that's not nearly, had the thing stepped out and began walking towards him and he's accounted for all his team and he can identify what it is, and yeah, he would have taken the shot.
Right.
And would have been open.
It's an important note because I think there's two things. I think that some people are frustrated by the fact that frustrated, I guess, is the word. But, you know, we have activity down there. We've had sightings down there, but we have yet to collect the specimen. And I think that this particular encounter, if that's what it was, and that's what it seems as though it was, highlights the challenge of working with an animal that is very furtive and stealthy and extraordinarily cautious and patient. They don't present themselves with great targets. And then the other side of that coin is those other people who think that we're just shooting at rustling bushes. Clearly that's not the case. If we were, we would have shot whatever that poor thing was, and it could have been, you know, could have been something else. And we don't want to end up with you know, some other animal that we're not trying to collect.
Well, both schools of thought are just so far off the mark that it's almost doesn't even warrant commenting on it. I mean, first of all, the people that wonder why we don't have a specimen yet and why we can't produce this and that, they don't have any clue. They really don't have any clue what it's like to operate in an environment that is, first of all, just hostile even to be there. And then you add on top of that that you're trying to collect an animal that is the most intelligent animal on the planet, or one of the most intelligent animals on the planet, is fast beyond most people's comprehension,
mm-hmm.
Is powerful beyond most people's comprehension, uses its environment to its advantage beyond most people's comprehension. And, you know, it doesn't matter to me if you think those are excuses or it's the truth. So,
right.
I don't care at this point. I don't really care what people say or think. You know, we're just going to continue to do what we're doing. And, you know, and what was the second? The second one was that, what was your second?
There's a school of thought that, you know, we're just a bunch of rednecks out there shooting at every sound in the bushes and we're scared of squirrels and stuff like that.
Yeah, that doesn't even merit any comment. That's ridiculous. It's just totally, totally, absolutely ridiculous.
Yes, it is.
Beyond the pale.
I agree. So you're going to go through highlights of each team that we've had so far. Besides that, I think that is the highlight of Alpha. But what else happened?
I would say that was definitely the highlight of Alpha. We did have one other event occur during Alpha that I thought warranted mention, and that was when I was not in Overwatch. I was actually out by myself. Two of our guys were in the cabin sleeping. We had somebody up in Overwatch, and I was just out trying to stimulate some sort of activity. I was, you know, 20, 30 yards in front of the cabin. And actually, Ken Helmer was on Overwatch. Ed Harrison and Rick Hayes were in the cab, and this was about, I think it was about 10 o'clock on that Thursday night. They were in there sleeping because they were prepping for, in fact, Ed's visual that he had that later on that night occurred. I mean, it occurred later on that night after this thing that I'm about to tell you about. They were sleeping inside the cabin getting ready for that. And I had been out there by myself, and I could sometimes mimic certain wildlife calls, you know, pretty decently. My dad taught me to, you know, mimic crows and lots of other animals growing up. So I don't know, it's just sort of a thing that I've developed. But I have a chimp, agitated chimp thing.
Yes, that, you do.
You know, I mean, if I don't say so myself, it actually sounds like a chimp, and I think it'd probably be hard for anybody to distinguish if they didn't know that it was me doing it.
Yep.
I was out there at about 10 o'clock, and I'd just been verbally throwing all kinds of things out into the air, trying to get some sort of stimulation, some sort of reaction. And so I did this chimp, this very, very loud, agitated chimp scream, hoot, pant hoot, all kinds of different things mixed in there. And had I been out there with myself, I probably would have wanted to shoot me because it was pretty obnoxious sounding. I mean, you think about a chimp when it screams like that, after a while, it gets very obnoxious. And that was my whole point, because I want to generate some sort of response. Well, I stopped doing the chimp calls, and within seconds, this big rock gets tossed from the side of the mountain. You can hear it ripping through the leaves, and it lands just behind the cabin, just outside the window where Rick and Ed Harrison are in their cots. And Ed heard it hit the ground and come through the leaves. And I mean, it hit just short of the cabin. It would have been a pretty good sized rock. It probably was baseball size from the sound of it. And, so that got my attention, and I did a few more chimp calls. And then, you know, within just a couple of minutes of the rock, I hear this weird vocalization, and I did a mimicry of it and recorded myself and sent it to Ken Stewart, who then manipulated it somewhat on Audacity. And I don't know if you can hear this or not, Brian, but this is pretty close. And this is, based on my recollection, this is pretty close to what I heard. Now, it wasn't this loud to me. It was probably 50, 60 yards off in the woods. Mm-hmm. This is sort of similar to what I heard. See if you can hear this.
Okay. Yeah, I heard that real well.
Yeah, that was very close to what I heard. And that, you know, all the hairs on my arm stood up when I heard that. And then it got quiet after that. You know,
what direction was that?
That was to the west.
Oh, to the west. So it wasn't It wasn't on the slope. It was over. Oh, okay.
All right. Not up there. It was just a different direction.
Yeah.
And I mean, it sounded like it was close to, you know, that west cabin over there.
Right, right. Oh, okay, sure. Yeah. So, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, that was definitely something that I thought was worth mentioning. And also we heard something, the first night we were there, we heard 8 consecutive wood knocks. And then on Overwatch, we heard that again. We heard it from the mountainside the first time. And then about 3 nights later, while Mark Porter and I were on Overwatch at 5:30 in the morning, we heard 8 or 9 wood knocks from the east.
Multiple teams have heard that this year, sort of repetitive banging kind of thing.
Yeah. Bravo, Charlie. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. People have been hearing it. So,
What's interesting about that sound, I mean, if that sound all by itself, if you were just in the woods and you heard that sound, I don't know, that just out of the blue, I don't know what you would have made of it. But again, it was contextually interesting in that you had been doing your vocalizations, that we had heard this, what was clearly a rock coming in to strike near the cabin, and then this all on top of, you know, themselves. So there's sort of a contextual interest because of all these other things that were happening.
Yeah.
Right.
And these series of knocks, they seem to have a cadence. I mean, it's like, you know, and you just count them. You count 7, 8, 9, you know, and but they all seem to have that similar cadence.
Do they get returns, or is it just, or are they just all by themselves? I don't recall anyone hearing that they've had it returned immediately.
No, I think the first night we heard it, there was some wood knocking going on in different directions from us. So it's say if it was responding to others or if there were responses to it. Definitely the one on Woodknock, that was what we heard for about an hour. We didn't really hear anything after.
Right. Before that.
And I can't remember the other teams, whether or not, you know, it was part of responses, but.
Yeah, so I don't recall that.
So those were really the highlights of Alpha, and otherwise Alpha was pretty slow.
Right.
And then Bravo team. Really, the highlight for Bravo team occurred on a Wednesday night when you can tell it better than
yeah,
I
Yeah, Bravo was my team, one of my teams. I'm going to be on three teams this year, and Bravo was my first trip down there. In fact, that was the week that I was there when I recorded the interview with Miz that everyone just heard on the show here. We were working on one of the weapons, ensuring that we had changed the configuration of the weapon. This is getting kind of in the weeds, but we had red dot scopes in front of the thermal mounts, and we decided to lose the red dot scopes because they were affecting our field of vision. So we were re-sighting the weapon with just the thermal on it. Yeah. And this was the Lapua, which is... No, you're right, the 4570. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Incredibly loud weapon. Yeah. I've never heard a weapon that fires as loud as this one does. And I feel bad for the guy who was sighting it in because he probably took that thing in his shoulder about 12 times, right? I mean,
a magnum round, so yeah, it was big hurting round.
So this thing was just making an awful racket, and in the midst of this, and I think there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of us there at the time, and we started to hear on the slope the sound of a tree. Well, actually, first we heard the sound of the tree.
Yeah, rocks were being thrown.
Well, yeah, previous to that, you're right. We'd had some rocks being thrown. Yep. That's exactly right. So previous to that, we'd had some rocks being thrown over the course of maybe half an hour or so in that ballpark. A couple of rocks here and there. Our speculation is that they either didn't like the guy who was firing the gun or they didn't like the sound of the gun. But we looked up at one point and we'd heard like this creaking and cracking sound, and I looked up and I saw a tree, a big tree up on the slope, maybe, I don't know, 50 yards away, start to lean. And this was a tree, man. This was not like a sapling. This tree had to be 70 feet tall. And yeah. I couldn't see the whole tree, but I could see the trunk of the tree start to lean. My first impression was not wood ape related. My first impression was I'm going to see a tree fall over, which just naturally, of course, trees do this. But I've never seen it before. So I got kind of excited and sort of ran a little bit closer to it. It couldn't really get up there because it was too far away, but I went into it to get a better perspective. And myself and at least three other people on the team were able to see from two different perspectives. Not this tree had stopped leaning, but at the top of the tree was going back and forth and back and forth and swinging around. And the analogy that sprang into my head and the one that I've related is you can imagine like these little playground equipment things, like the little, you know, the little worm that's on a spring and the little kid like goes back and forth on the, that's what this looked like to me. It was going like pretty energetically.
Yeah.
And then I realized that this might be ape related because that there was no wind. I mean, there was absolutely no wind in that was going on at this point. So there's no reason for this tree to be swinging around. I couldn't see what was doing it. But something was making this tree move. And so, I ran into it, get a slightly better position. I went to the other side of the cabin. And, as I got over there, we heard the tree snap and break, and about 20 feet off the ground, this tree broke and started to fall and got hung up in another tree. And so it never actually hit the ground. But what happened is when it stopped in that second tree, I didn't see it quite as much as I felt it and heard it, but something really heavy came out of that tree and landed on the ground. Now, at the time, again, there was distance and there was perspective, so I didn't really appreciate what I had just witnessed. But in retrospect, whatever was up in that tree could have fallen 30 feet, perhaps more.
Right.
And landed on the ground. And then maybe 3 seconds later, I heard it just take off like a shot. I just heard it like start tearing through the through the foliage up on the slope. So what's interesting to me about this is a couple of things. This is almost exactly, if you look at what happened to this tree last year when I was in there on Team Foxtrot, we had something similar happen in the middle of the night. Couldn't see the tree, heard the tree, break. And when I found it the next day, it was broken in almost exactly the same way. It was an older tree. It had sort of died up on top. It had been broken about 20 feet, 25 feet up in the air. So the whole top of that tree had come down. The tree that we had seen break and fall had basically broken in the same way. Again, you get back into behavioral questions. I don't know what else would have climbed up at the top of a 70-foot tree and jumped around like that. And again, our impression was either it was actually swaying back and forth on top of that tree, or it was jumping around from tree to tree. I mean, I think now that it was probably sort of riding the top of the tree, whatever that was.
Well, it's important. I think it's definitely important to note the context in which this was happening.
Right.
Within the last half hour prior to this event, you all had been witnessing incoming rocks from some points up on the slope. You couldn't Correct. See who or what was throwing the rock or you know sending the rocks your way, but there was something up there. You could hear some movement from time to time, and you heard these rocks. You could Right. hear them coming down through the leaves and hitting trees, and then hitting the cabin, the ground. So something was throwing rocks from up there, higher up on the slope. And at one point, and I think this is interesting, and I got a kick out of this when I read this in your field notes, you and a couple other guys got this huge slingshot.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. There,
and you began launching your own artillery back up onto the slope. You began throwing using the slingshot, and you launched 8 or 10 rocks up there.
Big rocks, yeah. Like, anywhere from like golf ball size on up. They were sizable stones.
And then this slingshot enabled you to get these rocks up there.
Way up there. Yeah, that thing's amazing. So, it's one of these three-man deals where, like, each guy holds one end and then the guy in the middle pulls it back. I mean, that thing, I mean, hundreds of yards these things were flying. If they didn't hit a tree, they went way the hell up there.
That's awesome. Now, how would, say you've got a group of chimps up there and they're waging war against you. I'll use that analogy. And how would the chimps take it if you start punching these rocks back at them? Yeah, they would.
They'd come down and rip your face off.
they might take that as aggression, maybe.
It's a good point. So I totally forgotten that.
So this tree, the incident with the tree did not happen in a void. I mean, in a vacuum. There was some stuff, some good stuff going on.
Correct.
During that whole time. And I have every reason to believe you had an ape up in that tree and it got up into a tree that it couldn't handle its weight. Maybe it became too zealous. It wanted to keep a good look at y'all. It wanted to watch what McAndrews was doing with the weapon. All sorts of things. Maybe it was up there and it wanted to throw rocks at you. I don't know, but I have every reason to believe that there was a wood ape up in that tree and it lost control of the situation. Maybe and the tree fell over. The tree broke.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things we've been debating because the thing about this tree. Is it to me? It looked like it had been hit by lightning at one point. It had sort of a long, all the way down the side of the tree. It was open. You could see that it was rotting inside. So this was not a healthy tree. I mean, it was all green. It was all leafed out. And if you had just seen it from, the side that we were looking at it from, it looked perfectly fine. But on the other side of the tree, it was all sort of rotted out and wounded. So this tree. So the question is, once you say, okay, fine, I think. Because of the context, again, because of everything else that was going on, I believe that was probably a wood ape in the tree. So when you say that, then what was its intention? Was it just trying to thrash around and say, like, I'm a big boy, the way that the gorillas will do? Was it trying to bring the tree down? Was it an accident? Was it on purpose?
It's a possibility that it was trying to do it on purpose. I mean, we've had, I forgot to mention during Alpha Team, while we were on Overwatch, we had a pretty significant event occur. And that was just, it seemed like it was 30 or 40 yards above us up on the slope. Yep. Kaufman and I heard two loud wood knocks, boom, boom, and then we heard this creaking, squeaking tree crashing sound. I mean, it just very loud, made us jump. So, this is not the first time this has happened. In fact,
That night we heard another tree from the south get pushed over.
Yeah.
And that was probably at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, somewhere around there. But this tree sounded to be old and rotted because it just sort of like the second tree. It didn't have the same sort of when fresh green wood starts to break, it makes quite the racket. How many trees have we heard now get pushed over this year?
We're about a half dozen now. I'm 52. I've been hunting since I was 5 years old. And hunting all my life, outdoorsman, very early on was hunting, had my own guns. And I mean, I had never, ever heard a tree fall in the woods until I started looking for this animal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, and particularly over the last 4 years, but the one that really stuck with me was in 2006 when my wife and I were out and we had done some call blasting. Within a few seconds after we stopped the call blasting, a tree got pushed over right across the river from us and scared us to death. So I think it's something they do. I think it may be some sort of display. I have my own theory about noise, or I think these things equate noise and power.
Yeah.
They think that whoever can make the loudest noise is the most powerful. And so in the woods, that's the nuke, right? I mean, other than throwing a huge, rock the size of a table or whatever, it would have to be pushing down a tree. I mean, that's going to be the ultimate thing out there that something could do to make noise if it had that within its ability.
And that point right there is exactly why my personal theory is that this wasn't an accident on the part of the ape. I think if you grow up in the woods, as wood apes do, you're surrounded by trees. Trees are, they're everything to you guys, right? So I mean, you really understand what trees are and how they work. And I think that a wood ape would have understood that tree was not in good shape because it was visibly damaged. But again, this is all theoretical. We can't be in the mind of the ape. We don't know what its intention was. But
as in tune with these things seem to be, and how aware they are of the cover and their environment, I wouldn't put it past them at all. Yeah. I mean, they use the woods, they use the forests like no other animal. It's incredible, man.
So that was Bravo Team's high point.
Yeah.
How about Charlie? Charlie had some really cool stuff. Really cool stuff.
It really, I think the activity stepped up with Charlie. Charlie had two or three visual encounters.
Mm-hmm.
Chief among those was one of our investigators, Shannon Graham, and Shannon Mason. Shannon Mason was behind her, but Shannon Graham saw one dart across in front of her at a distance of about 50 yards, reddish brown, stooped over. As it ran, she didn't have time to do anything but just stand there and look at it, and it was gone. And she heard a rock dislodge, as it ran up the mountain slope.
This is interesting to me because now we've got multiple investigators over the years, not just on that team, but from last year, from 2 years ago, Alton Higgins, from his sighting in other parts of Oklahoma, who have witnessed them running in this sort of stooped over at the waist, straight back, arms tucked up kind of motion.
Yeah.
Which is essentially what she described because she saw it very, very quickly, but that was her impression of what it was doing. It wasn't on all fours. It was more of like a bent over thing. That's what we saw, the sighting that I was part of, a couple of years ago, Alton sighting. So I think this is a really interesting, sort of just behavioral observation that occasionally when they want to really take off, they run in this sort of stooped over weird position, which, like I said, not on all fours, not quadrupedal, but to me, it just seems like a really, really uncomfortable position. But what's interesting is they have sort of a really straight back when they do it, which again, there's just suggestions of musculature and physical capabilities rolled up in that.
Well, I mean, it makes sense in a really dense environment.
Totally.
I mean, the times that I've tried to run in there, which aren't very often just because you fall and break your neck or your back,
right.
You have to stoop over to get through that stuff. I mean,
seriously, you, man, every time I go out now, when I'm out there and I bend over to get through some stuff and inevitably I will find myself having already traversed, you know, a certain period of time, like in that position, in almost that exact position. Now I can't do it. It's speed. You know, I can't do it for great distances, but I'll just chuckle to myself because I'm in that position. I'm trying to make a small profile. I'm, you know, as you're bent over, you're a little more torpedo shaped, right? So you're able to get through the foliage a little easier. But yeah, it's completely logical if you think about trying to get through that kind of stuff.
Sure, man. And so, yeah. And I had talked to witnesses before we started these four summer field study operations, these prolonged operations. I had talked to witnesses before who had witnessed something similar. And one sticks out in my mind from Southeast Texas, a couple. Driving down the road, down in Liberty, I think it was Liberty County, which one of Texas counties with the highest concentration of reported sightings. They saw what they thought was one running across the highway, and they remembered that it seemed to, it was stooped over, it was low to the ground as it ran, but running very quickly, and every so many feet, one of the front arms would come down and sort of slap the ground like. You know, it's just stooped over and it's using this arm just to kind of help it to propel itself. And I don't doubt that these things would do that just because of their posture when they're running. And
right.
And you see chimps when they run, of course, chimps are more quadrupedal, but chimps do that sort of thing. They sort of roll with their front arms as well. And so it just makes me wonder if these things tend to use their front arms a little bit, maybe when they're running like this.
Yeah.
But yeah,
that was good for Shannon.
Yeah, that was like, I would say that was the highlight. And then they had other things, happen during Charlie. McClurkin actually saw, he had a couple of visuals. They weren't really super clear visuals, but not nearly to the degree of Shannon's, but pretty sure they were wood apes. One was an upright, dark figure that he saw through the woods, through some pretty dense woods, as I guess 50, 60 yards away as it sort of walked along this trail. And, of course, all his team was accounted for, and it was big. And so pretty sure that's what that was. They spent most of their week finishing up on some of the construction that needed to be done. So they really only did overwatch a few times. And mm-hmm. They didn't really have anything happen during overwatch. Now, the Delta team –
Oh, you're gonna jump out of Charlie already? Because there's something I wanted to talk about on Charlie.
Well, then go right ahead.
No, the what I thought was fascinating observation. So I'm gonna try to set this up, and you correct me where I'm wrong. At one point, Mark and Shannon Graham had decided that they wanted to go. Had they heard some sounds? Is that what they were investigating?
Oh yeah. They were hearing stuff all evening. There were rocks being thrown.
Right. So they went off down this little clearing toward the bottleneck to observe, but they went without lights on.
Yeah.
And they just wanted to sort of like listen down there and hear what they could hear and you know, potentially see maybe something, but it was middle of the night, it was pitch black and they had no light. And then Shannon Mason came up to them with her red light on. And she came up behind them and asked them what they were doing, and they told her, and then she decided she wanted no part of it and she left. And what's interesting to me about that is if you weren't real good at keeping track of everybody, and then the two of them, Mark and Shannon Graham, were sort of kneeled down at that point. So they were down, you know, in the stuff. That could have, to you, looked like someone came over and then left, and maybe you weren't trying to keep track of the fact that there were two other people there. But what was fascinating to me about what they related is that they heard something that sounded like it was walking around on 2 feet, something that was bipedal, coming closer and closer to their position. And the super interesting part for me was it moved when the wind blew. So when the wind would die down, it would stop. And then when the wind picked up a little bit and there was some rustling in the trees, it would start to move again. So it was using the sound of the wind as cover. And this is one of the things that I've always wondered, because they can get really, really close. But
yeah.
But you don't know how to, I mean, because you never hear them, right? You never hear them moving around when they want to be. They're incredibly stealthy. So anyway, this particular observation by them that whatever this was only moving when the wind blew was just like, that's just super cool. That's a really, really interesting observation. And this thing got really, really close. It was coming right up on top of them, had no idea they were there.
within 10 feet.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, Mark, I mean, and they weren't prepared to deal with something, like just sort of stumbling upon them like that. So I think Mark actually like clapped his hands or something and the thing just took off.
A single clap and it stopped, and then it just sort of it reversed its course. Now people would say, "Well, why didn't he shoot it? Why didn't they take the shot?" Well, Mark said that the situation was not conducive to that, even though it was less than 10 feet away.
He couldn't see it.
He said it simply got too close too quickly, and that's a quote of his. It got too close too quickly. A missed shot or just scaring it would have turned out very badly.
Right.
It was best just to turn it at that distance, at 30 feet. At 30 feet, he would have taken a shot, but at less than 10 feet, he just was not at all comfortable, and he wanted there to be some separation between the two of them.
So I really enjoyed that particular account just because the potential behavior that it sort of illuminates is really fascinating to me. The moving when the wind blows to sort of hide the fact that it's there.
Yeah. And we've observed that many times and other people have reported that. So that's, again, that's just, from an animal that's very, very sensitive to its environment and the conditions. And it uses it. It uses every advantage it can get to keep itself hidden and concealed. It's crazy, man. Crazy.
So Delta.
Well, Delta, the first 3 days and nights of Delta was really just nothing but torrential downpours of rain. One of the guys posted on our internal private forum yesterday a video of Forrest Gump, from the movie Forrest Gump. He's walking. Says what he thought of Vietnam was it was just There was stinging rain. There was, rain from the bottom, and just, and these guys were just pretty much just, they had to get their oars out. I mean, they were just saw nothing but rain for 3 days and three nights. And when it rains in that valley, it can get very dangerous very quickly.
The creek was white water.
Yeah, yeah. The creek. So they were trapped. They couldn't even have gotten out at that time had they wanted to. And the sound of the creek is also, it also has a way of just, totally limiting your ability to hear. And so, as Mike Mays, who was the team leader, described it, it was the sound of the creek was like a roaring interstate highway.
He said it was like camping next to I-35.
Yeah, Interstate 35. Yeah. So, so for the first 3 days, I mean, the team did nothing but sit on the porch and just watch the torrents of rain come down. And fortunately, team Charlie had fixed the leaks from the new construction, and so they didn't have to deal with the leaks.
We had some guys discover those leaks in a rather unfortunate way.
Yeah,
when the water started pouring into onto their bunks and into their sleeping bags.
Yeah. So, but that was fixed with Charlie team, and so all Delta could do was pretty much just sit on the porch and. Just watch the rain, and that's about all they did for 3 or 4 days. So then it started, then it cleared up, and the creek started receding. And so on Thursday of Delta team, I got a call from them. Alton Higgins had a visual of something up on the mountain slope as Travis, Lawrence, Tony Schmidt, and Dusty Hathcote were coming down the mountain. They were in a different position from where Alton thought they were. And so Alton saw a figure up on the mountain about 80 yards away, gray in color, moved like, as Alton says, moved like a man. And he watched it for several seconds. He didn't see arms, didn't see the head, but he could see this figure up there in this opening in the foliage. And then it sort of jogged or moved quickly across this open area and was gone. And he had thought initially that he'd seen one of the guys. And when they came down, of course, came from a different direction and had a different color of clothing on than what he had seen. It dawned on him that what he had seen was something totally different. He described it as slate gray, very large. And,
this is exactly what has happened half a dozen times. I mean, this story of like, I thought it was one of our guys and then I realized it wasn't because it wasn't the right color and it was in the wrong spot or it was too big or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, that's the first thing people think when they see these.
That's just how your brain works.
From a distance, you're seeing an upright figure on two legs. You see it walking.
first thing you think, even though you're out there looking for this animal, the first thing you think is you're seeing a person from a distance. Now, mm-hmm. it's distance I'm talking about.
Right.
Close, it's a different story. There's some stark differences between us and them. But at a distance, you know, 75, 80 yards, 65, 70, 80 yards and beyond, the first thing you think is upright figure, okay, human. Mm-hmm. Then when you see a person, to give you that contrast, then you think, oh shoot, that was not a person at all.
Right.
Now my mind is able to process the two images, and they look nothing alike. What I saw was much bigger, it's thicker. You know, it moved. Right. It covered a lot more ground, much more quickly, bigger steps, all that sort of thing. And that's kind of what happened with Alton. It didn't dawn upon him actually what he had seen until the guys came down.
And then, right.
That was the highlight of Delta team, because they didn't really have much of anything else happen during their entire time there. And we think I've kind of suggested that it may have something to do with that creek being up so high.
I think it's a good theory. You know, water, there aren't, I don't care how strong or big they are, when that creek starts moving and, you know, you've got water that's you know, more than 6 feet deep. I mean, that's just an awful lot of force to try to get through. And it's going to hamper the movement of all the animals in the valley and all the way around there. You're not going to be able to get over that creek.
Right.
Unless you can leap over it.
Right.
And I remember last year being down there in not quite as bad, but similar situation to what these guys were dealing with. And that creek is really wide. It's really fast. And you're not going to, it's going to be hard to move around. And so I think that's a really good theory, you know, because we've tried to figure out like how some weeks are less activity and some other weeks aren't. And I think the virtual wall that creek creates when it's up and moving really fast, every animal is going to have a hard time with that. And they're all going to know it too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. It's definitely, it seems to create a natural environmental barrier.
Yeah.
And particularly if these things, if their core area is to the south of that creek, which many of us maybe think that it is, then yeah, it's definitely going to keep them from coming in there and doing what they do with us, which, you know, and even the question, I mean, many of us still have that question. Why do they do what they do with us? Why?
Absolutely.
You know, why do they do it? I mean, is it because they're guarding something and they want to make sure we don't get to it? We don't interfere with it? Mm-hmm. Is there a birthing area, a mating area? What is it that keeps them coming back? Because if it were me,
I'd leave.
If I were in there
and
I were trying to evade and escape, which I've been trained to do, I would not throw rocks at any buildings. No. I wouldn't even make my presence known whatsoever. I would either leave or I would get as far away as I possibly could while remaining in the area and never make contact.
Well,
these things, for whatever reason, like to make contact.
Right.
They throw rocks. They knock on wood. They knock on these trees, and we knock back, and they'll respond.
There's lots and lots of places, and I haven't clamored about that place like you have, or like a lot of other people in the group have. But I've been through there enough to know that there are places that are just really, really hard to get to. That any sane person, you know, because you know the area is used by some folks. You know, they're not too far away. There's some ATV trails that are occasionally used. So people come through there, but they go in very predictable ways. And even we do very predictable things. You know, we tend to stay in a place or the same types of places.
Like to use the trails.
Right. So if I was in the situation you were describing and I wanted to evade or get away or just not be known, it would be really, really easy for a reasonably intelligent animal to just, and not have to move. I'm not talking like they have to move 100 miles away. They could just like shift, you know, 200 yards over the crest into the next little valley, and you'd never know they were there. You would literally never know they were there.
Absolutely.
There could be an elephant living on the other side of that ridge, and we'd have no idea about it. You know?
This is all incredible. I realize to people this is just such an incredible tale, and you know, I'm sorry we haven't been able to offer that definitive evidence yet, but it, you know, it's it's So it's either that they're trying, they want to study us, maybe they're curious, they want to see what we're doing. They maybe it's because like you've suggested, Brian, we're cable TV to them. Yeah.
We're better than Game of Thrones, man. We come in there, we throw rocks back, you know, for them. This has got to be like, this is fun.
Or it's that we are a threat of some kind to them, and they want to keep an eye on us at all times because they want to know where and what we're doing. They want to know where we're going and what we're doing at all times.
Right.
Man, I just don't have – we don't have an answer for that. And it's something we're trying to get to the bottom of, but very difficult, you know. And it can be very frustrating. I mean, don't think for a minute that we don't get discouraged and we don't get frustrated and – nobody wants us to provide that definitive evidence more than we do. Trust me. We want to be able to share it with the world because otherwise all this is just going to be a story.
Right.
If ultimately we are unsuccessful in providing that type specimen without any other sort of hard definitive evidence, then this is all just going to be a story. That's all it's ever going to be. And many of us have spent a lot of time, a lot of energy, lots of money, tons of money. Mm-hmm. The group collectively has spent tens of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about what we have each individually spent, which is tens of thousands of dollars. So, you know, it's not that's the reason we're doing it, but, you know.
This question came up actually on the Bigfoot forums the other day. Somebody asked me this and
asked you.
Well, they asked me two things. They said, where's the evidence? And I pointed out that we're our objective at this point is not the sort of typical, quote-unquote, Bigfoot evidence that you find, like the footprints or
well,
whatever.
We found so many tracks, I've lost count of it. But what good does that do?
Exactly.
People
right.
Look at tracks like, oh, well, that's a human's footprint. Uh-huh.
Or you know, it's hard to see, or you could have faked it. Right.
Yeah. So we send a hair to a well-known geneticist,
yeah,
and
Brian
hair
Sykes.
Sample gets lost or whatever, you know.
We have no idea. Right.
We're past that. We send blood samples to another guy who's a geneticist. You know, he can't even extract anything from the sample. So mm-hmm. We're past all that. I'm sick of dealing with outside contacts. We can't even rely on. And
the objective now is proof.
It's got to be a specimen. It's got to be a type specimen, whether it's a body part or whether it's a whole intact specimen. That's what it is. And well, you know, some people find that distasteful and repugnant. You know, I don't even care. We don't care. You know, we're just going to do what we have to do, and you know, hell with the rest of them who think that there's something wrong with it. That's how science is done. It's every new specimen that comes down the pike, it's because they get a type specimen. That's just the way it works, and there's nothing unethical. In fact, it's unethical not to pursue it. If you have knowledge that this thing exists, and then you don't pursue it, and you don't take the steps to provide that type specimen, I think that's unethical.
It's a good point because we know, having operated now in this area for more than 10 years, we know that the pressure on this area is growing. There's more and more logging activity. There's more people than there used to be. Definitely, the pressure on all the animals. And when you drive through the forest, and this is what strikes me most recently, because this is the first year that I've actually been able to visit. I mean, anybody could. There's really not too far away, there's some significant logging activity. And what's interesting to me, well, not interesting, horrifying, is in northern Minnesota when they log, you know, they take it out in strips, and they tend to leave some areas of trees, you know, in between. There's just a different process that they go through. There's a different methodology up there. But in Oklahoma, and I don't know if it's state laws or if it's because it's, you know, some of this is private property versus public property, but they take every living thing off the ground. There's nothing left.
It looks like it's been nuked.
Exactly right.
We're talking 5 miles.
Ridges, as far as you can see, completely denuded of any kind of foliage. Now, set aside for a moment wood apes, Bigfoot, whatever. Living in that forest, there were bears, there were deer, there were all kinds of, there were raccoons and squirrels and birds and all those animals had to go somewhere, right? They didn't disappear. They didn't all just drop dead or evaporate. They all had to go somewhere. And that puts incredible stress on the entire ecosystem all the way around.
Absolutely.
And now imagine you've got some sort of apex predator, some sort of big old hairy thing that weighs 800 pounds.
Species that is discovered.
And imagine, so this is what frustrates me from, you know, there are people in the world like, oh, just leave them alone. They're fine. You know, they've been there forever. They'll be there forever. But you need to get out there and see what is happening to the wild places in this country, in this continent. This is an island. And it's an island that is rapidly shrinking, and something needs to be done.
If you took orangutans or mountain gorillas, and you placed them down there in that valley where we go, and then you brought in this sort of clear cutting that we're seeing, those gorillas and orangs, they wouldn't last long in there. I mean, because these sorts of animals require large tracts of unfragmented forest.
Right.
That's typically what great apes require. And so what's happened with this clear cutting that we've just seen within the last year there, I would say that a significant portion of their range has been diminished, because we're not talking far from where we operate. I mean, it's just a few miles, right, and it's pretty despicable, pretty disgusting. And
like we can hear the, and this is something that we've not really been able to discern before, but there were moments when I could hear the sound of their machinery.
You can,
you know, off in the distance, sort of rumbling.
I'm a free market capitalist, but I mean, come on, man. I mean, the land has been totally stripped of everything.
Right.
There is nothing there. And you know what it says? There's a goofy sign on this little fence that says, what does it say? It says, Steward Forest.
Something about stewardship.
What the hell? What forest?
Right.
All I see is a freaking barren landscape.
I bumped into one of the logger guys on the road, and he was prepping the road for some more operation. He said, "Oh yeah, we're going to be up there on the ridge, and we're going to do some more thinning."
Thinning? Nuking.
What the hell? There's like, you're not thinning anything. You're completely taking every bit of biomass off the land. And this is the thing. There are no, like, again, this is something that I see in northern Minnesota. You'll see like slash heaps or whatever. There's very little of even of that. I mean, they are literally taking every single piece of biomass away. It's incredible. And I agree with you. I mean, I'm not the kind of person who says that every tree should be preserved. And I mean, we need to utilize the environment. We need to have sort of we need wood pulp in our society. So I'm not saying that like no tree should ever be cut down. But there's got to be a better way than what we're seeing in this part of the Ouachitas.
Will be if we collect a specimen. I'll just say it. There will be.
Right.
Because I'm just going to say that we're going to try our best to have that kind of stuff stopped right there. And anywhere where we think these animals exist and it is a critical habitat area for them, just like any other special endangered critical species, we're going to get that area protected.
So the thing I want to end on now is the second part of this guy's question from the BFF is he asked me, when are we going to throw in the towel? When do we just say, well, that's it, we're done?
Why would we do that? What's up with that? I mean, why quit?
I knew you. Like, there's one thing I know about Darrell Collier is he does not quit.
No, I mean, why would you? Why? What's up with that? At what point will you just say they?
Well,
don't?
And he was asking from like, I mean, he wasn't asking from a you know, he was a supporter, but you know, okay, how many years of not achieving your goal will it take you to just stop trying?
None.
Right.
As long as I am physically able, as long as I can continue to do what I'm doing, I'm going to do it. People can go with me. They can follow me. They can come along with me or whatever. I'm going to continue to try to provide that top specimen as long as I'm physically and mentally able to do so. Yep. And so that means I've still got a long time. And, you know, as long as the organization and for Brian and me as leaders of that organization, it is our job to continue to motivate the members to continue to keep them motivated and keep them operating with that mentality that we will not quit. We're not going to, particularly given what we've experienced and what we've seen. Now is definitely not the time to quit.
Right.
I mean, yeah. We've seen so many things. We've experienced so many, we've documented so many things. None of that documentation means much right now. Mm-hmm. It will mean the world after we provide the specimen.
Right.
Because we will be able to write much of the book on their behavior. A lot of it, people aren't listening. They don't care. They don't understand. They don't want to understand. For instance, these animals, we think they're at least part of the time arboreal. They like trees. They like to get in trees. In fact, we think they probably spend a good deal of time up in the trees. And that would make sense if an animal wants to be in an old growth forest where there are huge old trees that can sustain their weight up in the trees. And I know that's not the image that the so-called stereotypical Bigfoot conveys, but I'm telling you what we've experienced and what we've observed indicates that they do spend time in the trees. They're very fast, very quick. You know, a lot of these things that just don't seem to be part of the stereotypical lore associated with this animal, we've observed, and we're going to write the book on it, but we've got to get that specimen first.
Yep.
And no, we're not quitting. So no, as long as I have anything to do with it, we're not quitting. I know I'm not quitting.
That's pretty much the answer I gave him. So I'm glad that we're on board together. We're you know, synced up on that.
Never quit, man. Never.
Well, thanks a lot, Daryl. Thanks yep. for, you know, happy Father's Day. It's Father's Day when we're recording this.
Yeah, happy Father's Day to you too, man.
Thanks for taking the time out of your morning to sit down and tell everyone what's been going on.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. We did hear from Foxtrot team last night. He's only been there a couple of days now, but they were able to add a cell phone booster to their cell phone, and they were able to call me last night at 10:30. When I first got that call, my heart jumped because
right.
Those guys shouldn't be calling me at 10:30 unless
right.
they had some pretty important news. And in other words, at that time I was thinking, well, they're out of the valley. They've gone out of the valley to call me, which means they may have a specimen or something with them. Turns out it didn't. They were calling me from the cabin, and one of the guys had another visual, a quick visual encounter. So things are happening. It could happen at any time. And, you know, we just keep doing what we're doing.
That's right. Well, thanks a lot, Daryl.
Yep, my pleasure. See you later.